Welcome to the Justin Ryan Bizarro Show. I'm Justin Bizarro. I'm your host. That's B-I-Z-Z-A-R-R-O. For anyone who's out there, you can find me on Instagram at Justin Bizarro. That's B-I-Z-Z-A-R-R-O. And if you want to listen to us, you can find us on Spotify or wherever else you grow yourself through podcasts. You can also find Justin the Food Entrepreneurs, The Night Dasher with Justin Bizarro, and The Centurion Leadership Battalion with Justin Bizarro, also all on those channels on Spotify, so or wherever else you grow yourself through podcasts. So I have Monica Burke back. How are you doing today, Monica?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm very good. So when we left off last time, we were starting to talk about you becoming your own entrepreneur. You're in a very tough situation. You're having to rebuild your life from a business partner basically being a crook, for lack of a better term, and you know, I'll call a spade, and but you're starting to like figure out life. You're starting to gain momentum again. You're really down. Things weren't working out. You were struggling to figure out what you were going to do. You had started going back to collections, but you have this opportunity to sort of get into real estate, and someone puts something in front of you related to that. And so we don't know where you go or whether or not you take the opportunity or not, but let's talk about this opportunity that suddenly comes out. You're in a depressed state, your family's in a trailer, you're having nightmares, but you're starting to get this opportunity potentially to be your own person. You know, amongst our darkest hours, there seems to always be the greatest opportunity, weirdly. I don't understand how that happens or why, but it is something in life. So let's talk about that, your this real estate opportunity that starts coming into your life.
Yeah. I got really, really blessed that, you know, when I was ready to give up, other people weren't ready to give up on me. And usually that's the opposite. I'm typically the person that won't give up on everyone else. Like, I care more than other people do about things. And if you're like me, that can make you a people pleaser in a lot of ways. And you really, really need to put a boundary there of you can't care more about anything for someone else enough for them. Like, if someone tells me they want to go into real estate, you know, I'm gung-ho. I think they're serious. But the moment I cross into I want it for them more than they do, that's a very dangerous spot to be in mentally. And it's just a good boundary. So, but for me at this time, I'm like really down. I just don't see a way out. I have people in the real estate business and friends that are just like, what are you doing? You know, you're letting this ruin your life. And I kind of knew that, but I didn't care at the same time. It just felt like impossible. Like, it just felt like after all the things I've been through in my life, like, I just keep trying and trying and trying, and it's just like, maybe these things aren't just not meant for me, you know? But that all changed, and really where it changed wasn't with from other people. There were a magnitude of things, but the biggest shift was my son. My son really was worried and taking all of this stress out on himself and believing that, you know, he needed to do something to get us out of the situation. He was only about 12 years old at that time, maybe 10, somewhere around there. And it was hard for me as a mother, you know, to see. And I remember it was just him and I in the car one day, and we were talking, and I just told him, I need you to focus on kid things. You know, I want you focused on like who you're going to play with at recess, what you're going to eat for lunch, getting your homework done. Those are the things I need you focused on. I said, I'm going to get us out of this. I said, I need you to trust me that I can do this. And he really didn't. He looked at me and he just was like, okay, sure. And that response, the fact that he didn't believe in me, because I wasn't believing in myself. Again, kids are just, he couldn't believe in past what he could see. He saw his mom giving up. So as much as I'm like, I need you to believe in me, he's like, eh, I can't really right now. Like, I can't put this kind of responsibility in your hands because you're kind of giving up. And if you're going to give up, then I can't, you know. And it was just very, very heartbreaking. And at the same time, I had friends reaching out with me saying, like, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? Like, seriously, I don't understand what you're doing. And it just was enough for me to snap and say, you know what? I don't know how this is going to end, but I'm already at the lowest, okay? Like, I don't see how it can get much worse than this. Like, all right, so if they believe in me, I promised my son this thing, I'm just going to do it. And sometimes that's what it takes in life. It just takes a wild ass hair to say, I don't even know how or what, but okay. And that's the beauty of it. When you're in the rock bottom, I mean, anything is literally possible. I mean, it's one thing to go from, if you're making $200,000-$400,000 a year to losing it all. I mean, that's a hard fall. But when you're already at rock bottom, it's kind of like the Great Depression. The poor they were already poor. They didn't feel much change. You know, they weren't the people committing suicide. It was the people losing everything that were taking these dramatic changes. And there's been studies, if there's a dramatic change in your income and you feel like there's no hope, that's when suicide rises. It's the feeling that there's no hope afterwards. And it doesn't have to be a huge hard fall. I mean, you could literally go from someone that's living on Social Security, where you have a guaranteed income, and that be taken away and not sure how you're going to make an income, and to head into that suicide mindset very fast when you believe there's no hope there. And I think that that's where I started really heading, and it was very dangerous. And again, it's just like I feel like God sent me people in my path to keep that from happening, from that tainting mindset. So I'm starting in that. I mean, things are getting better slowly. I have my daughter, I've had her, so I'm not pregnant anymore. Luckily, our bills are very, very low. We only need to make a couple $1,000 a month to survive. Which would be like one house a month. And the stress was on too, because summer was coming up. I could not afford childcare for three kids over summer. You know, I intended to keep childcare for the baby because it's, even if I'm self-employed, I'm there to do a job and I want to be professional, and I'm not trying to have a baby that's screaming and crying and needing all the attention while I'm showing houses and trying to help people make the largest decision of their life. So the older kids could go with me, but the baby still needed to be at childcare. So I needed to be able to afford that. Summer was coming up. I had about 3 months, and I knew I had to be able to supplement my income from my regular bail bonds collections job to real estate and being able to make that happen. So I was on a time crunch. And so the first thing I did was draw out a plan of like how I could do that. How many houses would that take? How many open? How many people would I have to get in front of? I mean, luckily for me, I wasn't starting at zero. I thought I was, but I did not take into account all of the experience I had accumulated to that point. And it took off like a skyrocket, like a skyrocket. It took off like a rocket ship because I knew what I was doing. I didn't have to learn sell psychology. I didn't have to learn the ins and outs of selling a house and all the things that can go wrong and, you know, how to write a contract. There is a learning curve. Everyone thinks you get into a sales job and all you got to do is show a house and that's it. Like, there's a million negotiations from beginning to end. And there's a million factors that can go inevitably wrong. And so it's that person, that agent, whoever you're using, you know, it is a huge, huge risk, honestly, to let someone help you that you don't know has a track record or just got licensed because of your sister or your brother. Their intentions may be pure, but they don't know what they're doing with your largest asset. Like, it's insane that you would leave it to that much chance. And I've seen so many things go horribly wrong. In that scenario, I mean, everyone's got to learn somehow. Just don't let you be the guinea pig to their learning. That's all I'm saying.
I agree with that 100%. You know, especially when it's a routine pattern in your life where people tend to use you as the guinea pig for their experiments, bad or good.
Yeah, or their business, whether that is they're starting up. And I'm not saying don't support your friends and family. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying before you invest your retirement or your savings into someone's startup, you know, they say 90% of businesses fail. That's not true. 90% of startups fail. And if they can get it off the ground, that's the time at that point to invest once they can get it off the ground. But until then, you're the one taking that risk for someone that really doesn't know what they're doing. And that's hard because you love them. And this is coming from, again, you're hearing my story. I understand why, even against your better judgment, you do sometimes. But sometimes it's just a way of doing it. It's not a yes or a no, black or white. You can just say, listen, once you get it off the ground, then I'll invest. You know, these are the boundaries I want to see first. And once you do that, then I'll invest. And that's a good way to protect yourself, give them what they need as well. Maybe that's the fire that they need, because if it's too easy to gain that money, raising capital has become a thing over the last 10, 15 years. And actually now it's kind of scary because people that are really in the investing world, a huge red flag is a company that's just raising tons of capital and hasn't done anything yet. So you should look at yourself as the big bank. Like, there's no reason that you shouldn't be looking at yourself. It's your money. You've worked so hard for that. You should expect a return on that. This isn't a charity decision when you're giving someone money to invest. So,
I think we talked about this. Well, maybe we didn't on with you. I'm having trouble because I have so many podcasts going on. There's no one's going to invest in you or believe in you like you. And when you invest in other people, it usually means you believe in them or believe in the mission more than them. That's the weirdest part for me, is if I've invested money, even in family members, what usually ends up happening is I end up doing the work because I believe in it more than they do, even though it's their business or it's their idea or whatever. And
again, it's that boundary.
Exactly.
That you want it more than they do. Like, you cannot, and you've got to have that boundary. It's so important to be very, like, I'm very, very clear about that now, that boundary, because I mean, and you're going to hear more as I'm going into this, because I started building this real estate business. I built a team. I've had lots of team members where I've wanted it more than they did for them. And you know who the person that ends up losing sleep and doing all the work is? Me. And then I end up resentful. So that's another boundary that I've had to set, is not only can I not want it for you more than you, another boundary is, I just lost my thought. I'm so sorry. As I was thinking, I can't want it more than you do. And then at the same time, the investment, it's got to be a two-way street. It's not a charity. Like, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with you for having an expectation of a return on your investment. And when you give someone money to invest, that's what you expect. That doesn't make you a bad person. That just makes you an investor. Like, everyone, that's what should happen. But if you're not from money and you're not from that, it's hard, because everybody wants you to give them something because they think it's not nothing for you, even when it's not always that way, you know. But anyway, yeah, as we're going through it, I'm creating this business. I'm thinking it's going to be back at ground zero. I forget, hey, I've already ran a sales business. I've been doing sales for many years. I actually know what I'm doing. So when I do an open house, I am going to yield a person at that open house every time. But that's because I know exactly how it works. Like, I know the language, I know the distance to give someone, I know the follow-up to give someone, I know exactly what it is that they're looking for and how to give them that. So that changes things. When you're new, I don't think you should have that expectation, because there's a learning curve there. It's going to take time. You need to have that expectation, because once you have that experience. But guys, if you've already built a business of some sort and then you lose it all, this is why you should not fear it. Because even after you lose it all, every time you lose it all and you have to rebuild it, it's faster and faster and faster, because you have connections and experience and knowledge and all the things that slowed you down in the beginning. You don't have that. So you can't fear losing it all. You know, there's a quote that says you're either playing to win or you're playing not to lose. And I've spent a lot of my life playing not to lose for the fear of losing. And you can't be. Like, you have to play to win and know that even if you lose, the rebound is going to happen faster and faster each time. So each loss gets better. It gets easier. It's less of a loss.
Well, and choosing the safe path usually isn't the safest path. Weirdly, everyone thinks it is, but it's generally not in life. It's generally leaving your life over to someone else, meaning you're turning your life over to someone else's hands. And while you think it's safety or you think that company's safety, it's often not.
No. I mean, even if you're in a job, the only safety is that you have trust and confidence that that company you work for is going out and getting jobs that's going to keep you employed, and they're doing good things with money that's not going to leave you high and dry. Your trust isn't in yourself, it's in that company. And so, and that there's a lot of great companies, by the way, not Andy, Ed, everyone I know in this world, they talk about that. Not everyone's meant to run a business, you know. And quite honestly, if you're a realtor or you're in sales, you're not an entrepreneur, you're an intrapreneur. You know, there's a lot of things that you just don't even have to deal with, because it does come from your brokerage. There is an umbrella, but you're not quite an employee either. And that's a great segue for a lot of people, because you can run your schedule, you can have financial freedom, but you got to understand you are still exchanging time for money in that position. And so it does get tiring, and you can make a great living, but it can be a continuing spinning disc that is never ending. So you never stop running. And so there are other ways. So I always thought of myself as more the entrepreneurial realtor, because I kind of picked up on that. So I get back in, I do meet our deadline. I'm able to spend summer with my kids and sell 2 houses a month, which is fantastic. For where we're at, so now we're able to like start not only just pay our bills and survive, we're able to go do things, small things like going to the zoo or to the museum. I know that doesn't seem like a big deal, but for quality of life, those are huge deals actually. More people need the smaller breaks than they need the huge vacations, and they're more fulfilling, they're less expensive, and they give you a lot more quality of life back. So those little things are huge. So we're starting to make it. That first year back in, I did about $1.5 million, which was fantastic for someone with no resources. All I had was a cell phone. I had no internet, no computer. My cell phone was a prepaid plan, so it didn't allow me to be on the internet and the phone at the same time. So I'd pick people up at open houses, or meeting them at different events and things. And then when they would call about a house they saw, I'd get them set up on a search, get them set up through everything within MLS. And then when they would call about a house, I would let it go to voicemail. I would text them that I was in an appointment and that I couldn't talk right at the moment, but I could text. So then they would tell me what they were needing. I would pull it up and then I would call them back and get acquainted with it. So, I mean, I just learned how to be very ingenuitive and resourceful, like, but I've always been resourceful my whole life because I never had everything that I needed. You know, I grew up poor. My parents bought a trailer when we were kids from a flea market that got taken away, which is in my book. So it's, those are the people that's, you know, that's the life I'm from.
So there was a lot of post-traumatic stress then because of what happened to you as a kid to you going into a trailer. It's almost like you had to go back and face the demon in order to move forward in a lot of ways.
It really was. It really was. A lot of that feeling of like, I never thought I would be that person again. You know, when you become an adult from a kid, you're like, I will never be like my dad, or I will never be like I will never live in a trailer park again. Never say never. You know, and even now, like if I have a choice, I will never. But and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not the life I want. Some people get really offended when I say that. I'm like, no, I mean, it's just not what I want. That's not the life I want. But, and I never thought I would have that issue because I've never been afraid of work. So I always felt like I could outwork my past, just like everyone.
Yeah, I see that. I'm the same way. I can outwork it. Or, you know, a lot of people keep themselves so busy that they never deal with it. But for some reason, it still comes face you smack in the middle. Like you're running around and then you forget about it. And then all of a sudden it's there. Like, and you have no choice. That's one of the craziest things I think about life. Or let me rephrase that. The individuals that want to grow in life, they tend to have to run into the obstacles head on. I don't even know how to describe it. If you don't deal with them or you don't work on them, you know, it's the real definition of imposter syndrome in a lot of ways. You're not dealing with something that's making you something and you're outwardly doing something else, avoiding who you truly are because you got to go face something. I can't even, for my own place, I mean, my reality versus my, what I felt inside sometimes were totally different places when I went through something like that, you know?
Oh, yeah. And it's not only it is facing, you know, your own judgments, because you have to be humbled to go up in life. We don't have to. There are people we know that have become, I do air quotes, successful. You know, they might be piss poor in their emotional and relationships, but monetarily they're fine. I think that to be the well-rounded person that I ultimately want to be, that I see in my dream life, that person cares and is compassionate about people and is not judging people, but instead asking how they can help change things. And I can't become that person if I'm judging the person that I used to be or where I came from. And that experience had to bring me back to that, if that makes sense, of like, this is how fast it can happen. It doesn't take someone to be lazy to end up in this position. You know, I mean, and even at that, I will tell you guys this, the kids that lived in that trailer park were a mixed bag of kids. There were some really awesome kids. There were kids that literally broke my heart because of their situation at home was not great. And you knew things were possibly happening to that kid that you couldn't. I mean, what are you, if you call, I suspect. And by the way, having come from very traumatic things in my life, I also understand unless you have damn good proof and you raise suspicion, it's going to create more hell for that kid. Just raising suspicion and nothing happening. And so there were things like that were going on, that you see this other world, that we live in these bubbles. But, you know, my husband used to say all the time, he was like, you know, I know why we're here. I don't know why they're here. And I know that sounds so bad, but I think that when you're on kind of living in the wrong side of the tracks. I mean, you see all kinds of life because you do. You see people trying to get ahead that have fallen behind. You see those people. You see, we had some really amazing elderly residents that were really great people, hardworking people as well. They've just had some setbacks in their life between death and different things too. And then, of course, you see people that move in and out a lot, or abusive situations, or drug activity. You see that stuff too. So it definitely was a good eye-opener. And the other thing with the trauma, when you talk about that response that happened, is my husband was like wanting to get out of it, that situation, much faster than I was. Ironically, I was the one saying, like, we should just buy land and move this trailer on land, because then at least we just own it. Nobody can take it from us ever again. We can fix it up. We can change it. You know, that's what I wanted to do out of fear of, again, not playing not to lose. Like, I'm tired of losing. I'm tired of always ending up with things snatched, the rug pulled from underneath my feet over and over again. I'm tired of that life.
Yeah, this is like, and I'll give an opposite example because I really want to nail this home. There's the very, very wealthy people that keep stacking their money in the bank but never living their life for fear of never having money. They never go live their life. It's always, and they're always fighting with people about money, or they're always having to, they're always, and people are like, oh my gosh, you have plenty of money. Why are you being like this with money? And because they have every right to protect themselves. They have every right to not spend their money and save it how there is. But there's an over fear of not having any. And it causes that person not to live their life and imprison. So the opposite is true also. You can have such a fear of not getting out of your situation, or in some cases, such a fear of having money because you've never had it, that you never actually get out of your situation. A lot of people, that I find that a lot. It's like, wait, you're afraid of having money subconsciously? That's really what's going on, because you've never had it, you know, and you almost chase it away in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You make it a scarcity in your life. And if it's a scarcity, you're definitely not going to have it.
Absolutely. And that it will hold you back. And that, for me, like I said, my husband would take us, you know, to go look at Home Depot, or look at, you know, one day we're going to have a kitchen like this, or we're going to, and I was like, no, like, why are you even taking me here? And then the kicker is I start selling real estate again, and I'm starting to have issues where I realize that I'm scared of rich people. I'm scared of money. I actually start realizing I have these issues. I've always wanted money. I've always wanted to be successful. Not for selfish reasons necessarily. Like, I want to have money so that I can enjoy life. You know, I don't want to stress. I want to be able to do really amazing things. I want to be able to create charities and help kids become people that they never thought they could be. And all that to say is I start realizing in that trailer park at my lowest low that I have really weird fears about rich people. I act different if I think someone has money, like weird, like awkward weird, like because I get my head that they had some kind of power, or, you know, like I needed to try to impress them. Always just feeling not good enough, because that's what the onion peels back to. Like, you're just not enough. And clearly they are, because look, they have success. And I started doing open houses at mansions and things, $1 million houses, properties. I worked for a brokerage that wanted to be known as the most elite brokerage, and with these really fancy listings and things like that. So it was easy to come by to do those opens. And guys, I would literally get hives and just would be terrified. Like, I would make myself do these things, and then I'd be like, why am I making myself do this? This is so dumb. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to start selling million-dollar houses. I wasn't that person. I was just like, I need to get around people that have money because I'm afraid of them. And so I started doing that, and it was awkward at first, for sure. But then I started noticing that people that would come in that would seem like they had money really didn't have money. And then the people that like really had money just didn't look like they look like me. And then I started getting into a coaching group at the same time. And at that coaching group, I have went to Dallas, Texas. They had it was right at the beginning of 2020. They had just started doing the COVID stuff. So we went to do this, like, it was a really small, intimate lunch, dinner thing with only about 15 people, maybe tops, because of COVID restrictions. And one of the people there was Jeff Ducharme, and he's a multimillionaire and several successful businesses. A really awesome guy, real down to earth. Cusses like a sailor. Just, if you saw this guy, you would not think this guy is pretentious or a millionaire. You wouldn't think anything of it. And I just, that changed everything for me. Because once I got into that room, I was like, this guy's just like me. He has no fucking clue I live in a trailer right now. Actually, at that time, I wasn't living in a trailer. We had already bought our house. But I was like, he's got no clue anything about my finances, could care less, you know. And it just, I needed to see that people are people. I know that's strange. Like, you can think that people are people, but we put these fears in our head. We put people on pedestals. We think that their life is better than ours or better than what it is. And I've learned that nobody's life is as good as you think it is. It's not. Like, they have their own problems. What you don't see is their little argument with their spouse that morning, or some crap they're dealing with their business, or like, you're not seeing everything. You're only seeing what someone wants you to see at all times. And so that changed everything. I, at that same time, I started had people coming to me asking about joining a team, getting their real estate license. So I started doing that. I started a real estate team. I figured that's a great way to get out of the sales spinning position of I have to work, because even if I'm not producing and my team is producing, then I'm still making money even when I'm not working. For me in my area, I will tell you that's in my head was a lot easier than what it was. Sales people that come into real estate, what's the number one reason they come into real estate? They want to own their own schedule. They want to be their own boss. They want to have no limits and get results with no boundaries or limits. And it doesn't work that way. And so when you're telling that type of personality that's coming in, I'm going to take some of your split. You have to split to your brokerage. And you know, I'm going to train you. I'm going to teach you how to do this. Most people say they want that, but they don't. They really want to be fed. And there are feeder teams out there, but it wasn't for me. It wasn't. I'm someone that really wants to make a difference and change people. So, and teach them how to do it. So I had a team for about 3 years. Did that, built up, went from doing $1 million a year to as a team doing over 12. With only two or three of us.
Did you still, I mean, what kind of real estate are you chasing at this point? I think that that's one of the keys in your story, right? Are you still chasing these bigger houses, these bigger homes with this team? Or are you sort of redefining what your business model is?
Redefining my business model. I didn't chase the bigger $1 million houses. That was only to get comfortable. My average clientele is like me, guys. I sell a lot of units, and I work with a lot of people breaking generational chains. I work with a lot of people who they're the first ones in their family to buy a house. You know, they didn't even think it was possible.
But you're still giving premium service, because I think one of the things people think, okay, lower amount of money per house, like I don't need to service them as well as I would serve someone selling a $1 million house. But no. I think your model in who you are, because I want to emphasize this quite a bit, because the customer service that you provide and what you're doing and who you are, I think is a really strong anchoring point at this point. Like you've been through hell, but yet you have this ability to connect with humans and give them amazing service.
Absolutely. So what worked for me is always having their interest at heart. So the one thing for me is like, I'm very strong in my niche, my people, because I've got their back like no other. I take it very, very seriously to protect them, because they're the most taken advantage of, because they have no clue what they're doing. They don't know what structural issues look like. They have no clue what a plumbing issue would be, or a slab leak, or like all these very expensive issues they have no clue about, and they get taken advantage of on the daily, because they're just, oh my God, you're telling me I can buy a house, and they buy a house without really knowing what they're investing into. And my people, I'm like, no, someone's got to protect them, and that person's going to be me, because I want them to stair step themselves into a legacy. I want them to be able to sell this house and buy a bigger house for their family and continue to build from that. And I have different clients that do different things. I have some that will buy a house, $200,000 house, live in it for 2 to 3 years. They'll refinance it, turn around, buy another same. They don't stair step ever into a bigger house. They're buying rentals. They're living there and then transferring them into a rental. And that's amazing. It works great for them. I'm only here to get somebody what they need and want. Like, I don't even look at price points. I don't care. I could care less. I'm going to get paid and fed. My family's going to get fed at the end of the day. We're going to provide premium service that I want to treat people the way I want to be treated. So it doesn't matter. Like, if I have someone that spends $600,000 on the house, which I do, and they turn around and they want to buy a $200,000 house, they're not going to hear any kind of budge from me. You know, I'm not the used car salesman that's like, but did you see this $700,000 one over here? Are you sure you want a $200,000 one? Like, that's never going to happen. I just know that if I give them what they want, it always works out. And so that's my only goal. Like, I'm literally, before every appointment, is what is it that this person wants and how can I get them that? That's it. It's very simple for me. So for others, though, they have ulterior motives. They're attached to the outcome. They're attached to the fact that they have this payment to make or this to do. You know, that I can be in the middle of losing everything at this point, and I am still going to work in your interest, not mine, because it always works out. If I work in your interest, my interest always works out.
I 100% agree with that, oddly. Like, it's the strangest, most inverted thing. And, like, this is the weirdest part, that God giving us free will, but also wanting us to have a relationship with him. It's this weird inversion that happens in life. And we don't understand it because it doesn't seem logical, but it is kind of logical. If we want what we want in life, we actually have to fulfill our purpose, which is taking care of the humans around us, growing the humans around us. We're meant to procreate. That's what we're designed to do, even if we don't. But then thereafter, all of our purpose is to still grow humans around us, whether they're our children, whether they're our families, whether they're a client, because putting someone into a home is growing that human. It's growing their possibility to have a family. It's growing. And if you oversell them and give them something they can't afford, you're doing the opposite.
Yeah, no. And I don't want to ever be that part. Like, I want the best for my clients. I'm their biggest cheerleader. Like, when whether they are buying something from me or not, like, when they have big life moments, I'm excited for them. I'm like, hell yes. You know, I don't have to be getting something out of that transaction or that a transaction out of that relationship for it to give me something back. And the other thing about that with the human nature is when you are focused on them or other people and their happiness, inadvertently, you always receive the happiness back. You live a very happy, joyful life. And the reason is you're not as concerned about your own problems because you're not thinking about your problems all day. You're not thinking about you. We are happiest when we're not thinking about ourselves, ironically. And also, we are at the same time when you think about yourself and what you want, but not in the form of judgment. You know, it's like such a yin and yang. We're like, don't pay attention to anyone else. Only focus on yourself. But the true happiness lies in other people and taking care of other people. It's the comparison once you start thinking, but that's when you start thinking about yourself a lot more. So it's like, there's definitely a balance there. It's thinking about people and their needs and how you can make that happen for them. And going to the ends of earth to make things happen for other people. And being very clear about what it is that you want out of your life. And not for other people. So you have like two missions. One mission is to get you what you want out of life. And you can do that by getting them what they want out of life. So we start working through that. In 2019, well, January of 2019, December of 2018, my husband talks me into looking at buying a house. I don't want to. I'm still looking at, like, we can move this trailer. He's like, Monica, this trailer is not going to move. Like, I'm telling you, it's not going to happen. He's like, just talk to your lender, which I was really shameful. Ashamed and embarrassed about our situation. He's like, look, you know him. He's not going to judge you. You're just like everyone else. If anything, like, they already know our situation. Like, you're not hiding anything. Just see. And so we put an application in with him and we just see. And he says, oh, all you have to do is save $7,000 for a down payment. He said, no issues. We can do it only on Nathan's income because he was on a W-2 job, so it was easier to finance. And he said, and Nathan had no debt because everything had charged off. So 2 years prior, he's like, all we need to do is open up a prepaid credit card and rebuild his credit, and you guys are good. Should take about 6 months. I thought, there's no way. I was like, I'm being punked right now.
Yeah, I know the feeling of that. Like, there is hope here. Like, are you kidding me? Like, I've been
destroyed. And it was so simple, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
I'm like, $7,000? I'm like, I mean, that's like two houses. Like, I could sell, it's surely in 6 months, I could sell two houses additional. Like, I start thinking in those terms. So I'm like, okay. Which I was being punked, by the way, because it turned into a lot more than that as we get through this. But if it would have been like, you're going to have to swim with the alligators, cross the shark tank and go through this and do this, I probably would have been like, nope, see, I'm staying right here. So it was a huge blessing at the same time that it seemed so simple. And what also helped is I created accountability. So we start looking at houses. Initially, I'm saying, you know, I would love to been somewhere around $150,000 in my area back in 2018. That was a doable budget. And, you know, I was like, I would love to spend that maximum $175,000. My husband was like, we need four bedrooms so that each kid can have their own room. I was like, well, there's no way we're getting that for $150,000. He was like a typical buyer. His expectations were insane. I'm a realtor, been doing it for a while at this point, and I'm married to a regular person, and sometimes it's a good eye opener. I'm like, okay, well, let's go look at some vacant houses so you can see what's out there. We go look, and, you know, everything in the area we were kind of wanting needed updated, and I just was tired of living in crap. I was like, if we're going to buy a house, I want to live in something that's nice, that I can just move in and I'm home. And so there was a program that allowed you to build and build your credit at the same time. Once the house, because it takes about 6 months to finish a house, by the time the house finished, you would just close because your credit would be rebuilt. If you needed to wait a month, it would wait for you. So for us, that seemed like a really, really great deal. And you got to really go through the entire building process. You got to pick your lot. You got to pick your paint color. You got to pick your updates. You got to pick your flooring. Of course, all of this is pre-COVID because they've changed all of that process. Now you don't pick anything. They just say, this is the house we're building. Do you want it? But that process for us was amazing. And then we ended up, our budget, we went all the way up to $197 and really got everything we wanted. I was very fearful. How were we going to go from paying $200 a month lot rent to paying a $1,300 mortgage payment? And it's kind of funny looking back, because $1,300 mortgage payment is a very low payment. It was at that time too. But it was real. When you're coming out of that, you're like, my reality is some months are still hard to pay this $200 payment. You know, what if I get into this and I can't keep up with it? What if I lose it again? And my friend said, Monica, I know you. That's never going to happen. You'll figure it out. You know, it's fine. And we just went for it. I remember praying. So the night we were going to put the deposit down, I couldn't find the checkbook. And we were so bad. Guys, we didn't even have a checking account because all of our accounts got closed due to all the things that happened with the old partner. We were living off of cash, which, by the way, living off of cash is way more expensive than getting a bank account. And we were living off of cash because nobody would give us a bank account. We were that bad. And just making your simple bills is like a trip to Walmart, standing in the money center line to send bill payments because you can't just pay online. It is very time consuming, and it's all the little things that you never think about. Our lender's like, you have to get a bank account open to, you know, we need that started. So I had an old checkbook from our previous bank account somewhere still. Just the builder was going to hold it until I gave them a cashier's check of the $1,000 earnest money once I had a closing the next week. But they were just going to physically hold the piece of paper to go ahead and hold the lot. And I was like, I'm such an idiot for doing this. Like, I feel like the most ill-prepared home buyer there is. Like, you just feel like everything logically is telling you, you should not be a homeowner. You know, you should not be doing this. You are not meant to be getting this loan because you can't even manage to keep a bank account. You know, all the things you're telling yourself. And I couldn't find the stupid checkbook. And I was having a fit that night, and I prayed. I just said, God, if it's your will, let it show up. If not, I'm cool. I'll walk away. Like, I don't have to have this house. I'm totally fine with it. And the next morning, it was right there. And so I was like, okay, we're doing this. I wrote the check for the earnest money, closed on the house, paid the earnest money out of that, and started going through the process. It kept us so accountable because we would go out to the house every week, sometimes twice a week. The house was not in the area that we wanted to be in necessarily. It was further out. It was about a 45-minute drive from where we were living. But we had a really, really good feeling about it because it was very convenient to everything else. We were like, once we're out there, it'll be nice. But it was definitely not like an easy hop and skip down to go check out the progress of it. At the same time, we would literally visualize when we would come out, we'd take the kids out to look at the house. every week. And then we would be like, okay, let's go to Walmart from here and see like what our life's going to be like when we got to run to Walmart real quick for some groceries. Oh, let's run over here. Like, we would spend as much time in the area as we could to become more and more familiar with the area. And then our kids at the same time really did not believe it was really happening. Like, they felt like the rug was going to get pulled beneath their feet. Like, they were not excited up until like the last 30 days when the heat really started to come down, because we had repossessions on our credit from before it all the charge-offs and everything. And the small credit union that we had the loans through had kept reporting it as a new repossession. So that way, when we would try to get credit or something, it would go against us. And it's illegal for them to do that, but they don't care. And they're a very small credit union. They were like, this is how we get paid. Like, literally, they were like, this is how we make people pay us.
Yeah, I want to anchor this actually just for the audience, like, and just because I think it's important. Bullying, harassment by companies, by individuals, people that cross state lines, like over social media, digital, coming after people, all of that stuff, even though it's all legal, it very much exists in our culture and in our lives, particularly even from businesses. I just want to emphasize that because I've experienced crazy things, not this exact same scenario, but where you're like, are you serious? Like, you're going to have, you're threatening my kids and my family? Are you serious over this? Like, over this?
It was like, you're like, really, we're talking about from buying this house because of this car from years and years ago, like years ago.
Yeah.
And it was bad because the underwriter, once they saw that, they called our loan officer, and they've done a lot of loans together, so they know each other. Again, this is all the little things, you guys, when you're buying a house, use a local lender, because I'm telling you, it makes a big difference. This is a prime example right here. She said, normally I would just decline the loan because it would be like, this person does not qualify, which is horrible, because if they decline the loan, like, we're screwed. You can't just reopen it, especially with FHA. And she goes, but I decided to suspend it and put it on hold, because she goes, I know you, Kari, and this, you wouldn't just send me this. So this doesn't make sense. So she said to the loan officer, and he goes, well, I personally know these people, and I can tell you they did not have a repossession last month. He goes, let me figure out what is going on. And yeah, that's all it was. It was, they were like, this is how we get paid. We force you to pay us by inaccurately reporting it as a fresh repossession every month. And
so you get into the house you get through this. I can't even imagine, like, you guys are in the house.
I about lost my shit over the counter. Well, yeah. We did get through it. So there are ways to work around. So the underwriter on the phone, they would say, yes, we could see you voluntarily gave it back on this date. Yes, we can see we sold it at auction on this date. They would say that on the phone, but they would not put it in any kind of writing. So the underwriter overwrote it for the loan, since they did do that. It was like a very one-off crazy fucking thing. We get the house. We close on it. And I got to tell you, it was the most exciting thing, because not only did we start off with a brand new house, we bought brand new furniture, pots and pans, plates. Everything in our house was new. We didn't take anything from that trailer because it was full of roaches. And, you know, I didn't want to take that into our new house, any of that shit. The only thing that we took with us was clothing. Literally, everything else we had been buying slowly. I would close on a house. We would save our money. We would make sure we had the money in the account. We were paying off debt still. I paid about $40,000 that year off in debts to people that I owed money to, like the trailer loan, all that stuff. We saved the money down. We saved the reserves that they required. We bought all new beds and couches and plates and sheets and towels and shower curtains. Every time I would close a little bit, we would go on shopping sprees. And it was the funnest thing. It was like The Price is Right, just with a cart going through TJ Maxx, being like, I love it. Not even having to look at prices, just like, I want this. I love this. Our only rule was we don't buy it unless we absolutely love it. So if you pick it up and you're kind of like, I don't know, it's a no. When you see it and you're like, I fucking love that, done. And so when we started, I mean, we really started brand new. Another thing we did prior to that, when we knew we could buy a house, guys, is I just went on to PowerPoint and created a slide, a collage of all the different types of houses we would love to have, what we felt was reasonable, not McMansions, because we weren't going from the trailer park to a McMansion $1 million house. I mean, it is possible, but I didn't foresee that as our reality. So I chose houses around the 150 to 250 price range. Like, and I made a collage and I put welcome new homeowners, August 2023. And that's the date before we even, the 6 months we got back from, right when we got that back from the lender, that was our, with buffer time, August of 2023. We closed August 2019. I'm getting my years mixed up. All the 23s. 2019, we closed August 23rd. And we've had it everywhere. I had it on my front door of the trailer, in my bathroom mirror, literally everywhere. My kids were like, Mom, you're crazy. And I was like, no. And that's where it's the power of envisioning. It's so true. I would literally be like, oh, look, there's me coming home from a listing appointment. Oh, look, there's my kids not doing the chores like I asked them to do. I would like literally like, I want to make it real in my head. What does that life really look like? Not the,
I know. And it's so interesting.
Glamour snapshot.
Yeah. Cause you're manifesting what you want. You're actually making the future comfortable for you, because if you're uncomfortable, you almost reject it. It becomes a scarcity. But if you're already living in it, it's very easy to go there and be that.
Yes.
And it's weird, and because other people outside of you who don't get manifestation, they think you're nuts. If you talk about the future in any way that you're manifesting it, that they don't understand, they're like, oh, you're crazy, you're a liar, you're whatever, because it's not happening right away. But what you're actually doing is creating the mental vision so you can go enter the space. It's crazy, but I agree with you. Go on. I love this.
Yeah. So I'm doing all these things because I want this more than anything. And it really, once there was hope, once there was like, this really can happen, that changed everything for me. And so it was like, all right, well then I'm fucking dialing into it. I don't even want to second guess it. Because if that's a life you're saying I can have, then I'm going for it. Screw it. And we get the house. We close August of 2019. We're stable. My business is skyrocketing in that 7 months of getting the house. You see where I was at, right? When I put the deposit down, like, I'm waiting on this closing. I'm going to make a couple of thousand, and I don't know how I'm going to do the rest. Surely I can come up with two houses sold to come up with a down payment, to paying off $40,000 in debt, to coming up with a down payment, to including with closing costs, to include a house full of furniture and all the necessities. I mean, it went from making maybe $50,000 a year to making about $150,000 a year. And we were ready for it. Like, before, when we used to fight, a lot of our fighting had to do with, we had different ideas of what we should do with money. Neither one of us came from money. So when we even started kind of making money, even just a little, we had different ideas about what we should be doing with that money. And this time it was different. Like, we were on the same page. So we attracted more money. It was very, like, understanding. And I got to tell you guys, we still do that. Like, every day, my husband and I, we spend at least 10 minutes a day discussing our future plans monetarily and just making sure we're on the same page about either what's coming up next in the next year, next month, or the next couple of years. Because you have to be on the same page, or you will actually block the receiving of that. You just because you won't be on the same page and you won't know what to do with it, and it will squander and it won't happen. But if you're like, we want to receive the money, this is exactly what we would do with that money, we can see ourselves living with that money, this is the life that we want to have with that money, and we're together on the same page, it's going to happen at that point. So we start doing those things. We close in August. We're doing better. We decide we're going to take a trip to Vegas in January, just my husband and I, for the first time. We've never been to Vegas, and we've never really taken a trip, just the two of us. So we do that. We're very excited. We're very overweight. Health is one of those things that we were kind of trying on for a while, and then we were on the off, and then we were focused on business. And now it was on the forefront of, like, we really need to, when we get back, we really need to do something. So we go to Vegas. While there for that weekend, it was just a weekend trip, I could barely walk. After one day of this trip, my legs started to really walk up really bad. My feet were completely inflamed. And my knees were completely locked up. I mean, it was really, really bad. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm fatigued. It was like, I'm in excruciating pain and can barely move, like baby steps. I was mortified and ashamed because I was 29 years old. Well, I just turned 30. And I just remember looking at my husband. He was upset because there's so many things we wanted to go do and explore and experience, but we couldn't because my body was limiting us for my lack of taking care of it. And there's no one to blame but myself. And there's so many things we wanted to do in such a short amount of time, and we couldn't do it. And even the airplane ride there and the airplane ride back was horrible. We were so big, I could barely get the airplane seatbelt on. In fact, they were questioning on whether or not to try to have to move me. We might not have been able to fly. I was about 250 pounds at that time. I'm only 5 foot, so it really stacked. I was just mortified, and I remember standing there on the strip looking at him going, I'm only 30 years old. What is this going to be like in 10 more years? Like, I'm going to be in a wheelchair if I keep this up. And it snapped. I was like, I have to change this. So it was one of those things for me. As soon as I came back, I got involved in a boot camp I thought they ran in challenges. But I was desperate to change. So I got involved, and it really actually was a class. They just happened to have a new year challenge at that time. And my only thing was, I have to show up every day. I did the 8 o'clock class. I didn't start at 5 a.m. I wasn't this intense person that I am today. It just grew. It grew first for me. It started in business out of necessity. And then it changed, it grew into physical. And now I've lost over 115 pounds 3 years later. You know, we had COVID right after we bought this house. That 6 months later, COVID was a big thing. We believe we caught COVID while in Vegas in January, because a couple weeks once we got back, we were really down. Like, there was one night I could barely breathe. And I remember thinking, this is like death. This was not the flu. And it was right before COVID came out. It was in February. So there were all those things happening. And then COVID happened in March. 3 months of working out consistently, not really getting huge results yet. My body's hanging on to everything. And COVID, everybody wants to shut down. And that was an excuse for a lot of people to gain a lot of weight, to drink a lot, to eat a lot of bad things. And for me, even when the gym shut down, it was, I can't go backwards, because if I stop, I won't pick this back up. So my only thing for that day, every day, was I have to get a workout in, whether that was just going for a walk around the neighborhood for 40 minutes, that counted. you know, I wasn't judging myself too harshly, but at the same time, it was, this has to get done every day.
And it's one of those things that's like, if you don't hate it, you tolerate it. And if you gotta hate going backwards so bad that you will not tolerate it. That's what I found, because I was about a year into 75 hard at that point, going on year two. And like, I had a gym in my garage, like, let's just keep this in mind, but the whole world shutting down, the not being able to travel like I was for work, feeling like a prisoner in my home, like all these obstacles, like, were crazy. I had my, you know, sister-in-law living there. I had, you know, both my stepkids plus one of my stepkids now fiance. And I don't know, this weird thing happened, everyone, and I have more than enough. Believe me, I've worked very hard. You know, Deborah had worked very hard, or works very hard. Sorry, it's present. And,
yeah.
But it's one of those things that you almost have, not only are you fighting trying to keep working out, you're fighting like society as a whole that's telling you to fucking chill out, not do anything, go at home, take the government's money, and become everything that you're trying not to be, everything that you didn't want for your life at this point, you know, especially for you.
And it was super fearful because about March, April, May, this is before real estate skyrocketed. There was a period where we were all very fearful of, like, we don't know what's going to happen next, and nobody was doing anything. So it was kind of right before the skyrocket. I was just like, I have to keep showing up. So I was showing up to the office. I was showing up. I mean, that was just it. It was like, I just have to keep showing up. And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned through everything. It is, when you quit showing up, you're toast. You know, when we were losing everything, I quit showing up to the office. I didn't want to get out of bed. It was so overwhelming. It just felt like there was no hope as we were losing everything. And I felt like...
I agree with you. When you lose hope, it's so hard. So hard.
Yes. It's like, all I want to do is lay here. And I was pregnant, and my, like, I felt so not me. Like, I feel like normally me is like, I'm going to fucking fight back. Like, that's my reaction. But when I was pregnant with Maggie and going through that, I didn't have that. Like, I didn't have that. And that was my lesson. So now I know when my reaction is to want to, like, ooh, that's, this is hot, this is hard, and I want to kind of hesitate or hold back, I'm like, no, I can't, because I know you're toast. The moment you stop showing up, you're toast. You cannot stop showing up. So that's it. And now I'm at this point, I'm 115 pounds down, 3 years later, continually doing it. I own, part own Total Body by Total Boss, with Miranda Jiggins, a personal trainer and a bodybuilder. Sorry, my brain is like spacing out on me.
It's okay.
But we, you know, that was created out of giving people viable tools in a community and having a personal trainer in your back pocket for the busy professional, because we're busy, and that's everyone's biggest excuses. You could be rolling in the money, guys, but if you're not taking care of yourself physically, you're going to pay a lot for that. And you're, I hate to tell you this, but you're also not doing as great as you would be doing if you were, because it's so easy doing an extra call or making that extra email or dealing with that fire when you feel good. It's easier to take on more when you feel good. It doesn't feel like extra. But when you feel like crap and your anxiety is high and your blood pressure is raised and you're already feeling like you're on attack all the time, it is hard. It's hard putting out that fire. It is hard making that extra call. You might feel like you're doing good, but you could be doing great if you were taking care of yourself. So those are the things with that. It's like, okay, now it's inspired me to do this really awesome platform for people wanting to get in shape or continually be in shape. For me, now I'm at a place where I don't like to go to the gym as much because it's more of a distraction. It's a pain. I don't have to be in the right place at the right time to get it done. And some of that's from 75 hard. I just want to jump on, get on it, and get off. When I stopped going to the gym, that saved about an hour of time back in my day. And the way I see that is I can, if I need more sleep that day, I can use that hour. That's an hour of my time because the quality of the workouts is from a personal trainer. And it is done correctly. So there's different ones. You can jump in and do a 10-minute one, a 30-minute one, an hour. There's different levels, expert, beginner, and those things. So now I'm working in that. I've created a business called Momentum by Monica. And that business is to help sales professionals, sales agents, or those in relationships that are wanting to create momentum in their life, whether that be in their fitness or in their business, in their sales. These are all things that I've done from the ground up. These are all things that, you know, I feel as an expert in. I've created momentum in many things in my life. It's all backed by research too. Actual research that has been done by the U.S. government on psychological positive momentum. You can also have negative momentum. You can be moving momentumly and backwards, and that's not good either. So everything that I do is to teach people how to harness their power, create their power, and use it for what they want, whether that is buying or selling their house, whether that is they're an agent and they're wanting to increase their sales and go from, like I did, 1 million to over 10 a year. That's my job, is just to get people what they want and how to do it.
Love this. I want to like just get this get this out there. Because I know we're going to do another podcast with your new business partner, or the project that you're working on, and you mentioned her. So I don't want to go too far in it because I want to sort of tell your story. But you've been able to make it through something like a lot of hardship. You've been able to do a lot of things. And I don't want to take too much time to do this, but if you could tell yourself now, or if you could tell yourself 10 years ago what you know now, what would those things be? Because you were in, and I think it would help a lot of the listeners in the audience to understand what it's like to pull yourself out of struggle. What are those things that you would tell yourself 10 years ago?
Oh, so many things. 10 years ago. All right. Listen, you already know what's up. You know, they say a woman always knows. Like if her, I say a person always knows. You already have a gut feeling. You already know when someone isn't treating you right. It's usually the logic and emotions not making sense. The two aren't aligning and you're like, something's off. I can't put my finger on it. Sometimes you got to tap into that emotional side and just say, even if it offends somebody, you know what? I choose me. Like, I don't have to have a reason. It's not me against you. I still choose me. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's definitely number one. If feeling like I could stand in my decision and say, I choose me first and foremost through anything. That would be advice number one. Only you have to live with you. So, I mean, of course, my spouse has to live with me and things like that. But if he decides he wants to leave and divorce, I mean, at the end of the day, it's me with me, no matter what happens.
Absolutely.
So that's number one. Number two advice I would give is if you can understand why you do what you do, you'll understand everyone else so much better. Not to make excuses for people, but if you can understand why you procrastinate, why you don't do the things you say you're going to do, why you break your own promises, why you lie to yourself. If you can truly answer those hard questions, you can totally actually understand everyone else, and it will make your business run way smoother because you'll know what to say to them to get them moving in the direction that they really want to move into. You'll know when to cut it loose and not hang on. It makes everything so much easier, which brings me to number three is, people are honest with you. You just have to listen. And quit looking for people to be what you want them to be in your head, and allow them to be who they are. Whether that's your kids, your spouse, your clients, your employees, they are who they are. They're never going to be who you want them to be. And, you know, there's 500 different versions of us, depending on the person you ask. And each one of us has a completely different perception of ourselves, including of ourselves. Like, my perception of me is going to be very different than Justin's perception of me, or my husband's perception of me. And so at the end of the day, I guess it goes back to number one, is your perception is the most important. Who do you think you are? And allow that for other people too. Their perception of themselves is more important than your perception of them too.
Yeah, I've heard this saying that's a really great saying on this. I'm sorry to interrupt because I want you to finish your thought. But it's, we see ourselves how we think other people see us. It's not even actually how they see us a lot of the time. It's how we think they see us. And it leads to identity crisis, depression, not being in reality because we're not living up to who we really are. You know, and we sort of go through life, we're unhappy in our marriages, we're unhappy in our lives, but that's because we're doing this weird game of almost becoming who we think other people think we are, and versus becoming of who we know we are, what God instilled in us for that, or a higher power. You know, what are the things that I have instilled inside of me that I need to grow, you know?
And that's where it's getting quiet. So there's that duel where it's like you matter 50% of the time as much as everyone else matters the other 50% of the time. Like, you matter, number one, and then everyone else. But at the same time, the reason that you do things can't just be for you. It has to be for other people too, and for the collective good, the greater good. So it's a weird symbiotic. It's the yin and yang of life. But in a weird way, if you look at it, we're all connected at the same time. When you do things for you, you're really doing it for them too, because you're the best version of you showing up at that point. And if the best version of you is showing up, that means everybody else is getting the best version of you. So it all comes together. And then I would say the other lesson I would say too is just, having gone through so many things, I would ask, who's getting the best version of you? You know, are the people that you're doing all this for? I mean, there's been so many times in my life, you know, I do these things for my family. I do these things for my kids. And the people that I'm doing all this hard shit for, at the same time, they're not getting the best version of me. Isn't it ironic that sometimes we're doing all this stuff for the people we love the most, but the people we love the most is getting what's left of us, not the best of us?
Yeah, and they don't even actually like the leftovers anyway.
No, they get really upset. So
yeah, it's crazy, and I've done that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's ironic, but we do that. And if you're an entrepreneur, you do that. So evaluating that at all times of just, hey, are you taking care of you first? And then are you taking care of the people you're doing this for anyway? You know, are those people getting the best of you? And are you making time for them? Are you making time for your spouse, even if it's just a weekend getaway? Like, we don't do big trips in my house. We do like little weekend, extended weekend, quarterly trips. We get the most out of that time. It's intimate. I can really concentrate on them. I've learned, for me, more than 3 or 4 days, my brain goes right back to business. There's no way I can do like a 2-week trip and not work. There's just no way. But yeah, I can.
You don't want to be around me anyway, because I start getting anxiety over work and stuff. And why do you enjoy long trips? Like, weirdly, this anxiety starts creeping in.
I have to be able to work. But 3 to 4 days, I can commit that to my family and put the laptop away and not work. You know, I can. And I have set up my business to have that kind of leverage. And if you have a business and you don't have that kind of leverage, that is like step one. Because you are going to run yourself into the ground. You are still exchanging time for money. So That would be it. It's just, and then the last thing, the last lesson, honestly, the advice is this. I posted on Ed My Let's Sing the other day too. I said, everything is figure outable and it always works out.
Yeah.
In the end, my mom, I'm in tears, pregnant with Maggie in North Carolina, and with living with my parents, going through all this stuff. And I just remember being like, Mom, I don't know that this is, I just don't see how this is ever going to be okay. And my mom said, it always works out. She's like, I've learned. She said, Monica, there's times I wasn't sure how I was going to feed you guys. And lo and behold, there'd be a check in the mail. I wasn't expecting it. I had like a random refund that I got. And she goes, I literally had no clue how I was feeding y'all that night. It always works out. I mean, and that's just basic human necessities. Those are the things that we fear the most.
Yeah.
So it's always figure outable. It's going to work out. You just have to put in the steps. You have to go through the middle, the grime. And at the end of the day, and by the time you get to the other side, the other thing I've learned is there's always another mountain. Yeah. You just can't see it till you get there.
Be scared of the downward trend after you've climbed a peak, because that just means you're going to hit a valley and have to climb another mountain. That's what I've learned. Everything is in cycles, you know.
Oh, for sure.
And whatever mountain we've climbed and conquered, there's another one waiting for us, another spirituality, another thing from our childhood that we don't know about, another thing in our relationship that we're going to have to deal with. Life just doesn't allow us to be stagnant. And those that find stagnation in life don't live life. They're wasting it, honestly. And that's my opinion. I was weirdly born with that in me, which frustrates me about most humans. Like, the thing about humans is, it's not that I don't like them. It's that I find the frustration of wasting their time that they have here, not spending the time with their families, not doing the things. And you just talked about it a little bit. It's like, we have a very blessed life, and these things are opportunities. They're another fucking growing opportunity, is what I call them. I'm AFGO. Here we go again. What am I going to have to learn now? What skill am I going to gain on this? Okay, but now I know I gained skills in the downtimes. And in the downtimes or the transitional times, I've gained some crazy weird skills that weirdly sometimes months, sometimes years come into my life, and I'm like, whoa. I had no idea why I flipped donuts. Like, you know, we needed money, and I was putting the money into my companies, and we needed extra income. I'm going to flip donuts. Well, that donut flipping has opened up a shit ton of money for me. I say flipping donuts, which is really frying donuts, because you have to flip them in the fryer. And sometimes it's a machine. Sometimes it's you, depending on the style of donut. And but it's one of those things where there's a humility, and there's a skill that you gain, or a way of dealing with things, or something that happens that if you really pay attention in life, these are the things that mean that have opportunities happen, meaning you're prepared for some reason for these opportunities. You don't know why, but that's why I don't care if you're a French fry cook. I don't care if you're a DoorDash driver. None of that means anything. And Monica's story, the thing I love about it the most is you've got to look at life that nothing's below you. Because when you're willing to do the things that are below you and be a servant leader, like God, like Jesus instills in all of us, it's one of the five seeds that's been inside of me. I'm a leader, but I'm a servant leader. I like to give more than I receive. I feel uncomfortable receiving. Okay, it's something I really have to work on, and I constantly have to accept when people are giving to me because I don't like it. I can be stubborn. And what I want to say about your story, Monica, is you are just at the beginning. Like, that's the part about you that I think is the craziest part. Like, everything you've been through, the having kids, the going through the obstacles, writing the book, it's just the beginning. And it seems crazy because you've lived a long life, you know, a hard one so far. But it gets us prepared for our next journey. You know, you're 33 years old, you know, and Jesus's age, I don't think is a coincidence. A lot of people have a lot of stuff, and around that age, you get to choose a difference. Life stacks up skills, and you get to choose a difference. Life will do it to you again if you're not humbled or you're not on the right path. Believe me, it'll give you identity crisis, and it'll give you imposter syndrome. But the most part, it's life's doing for you what you can't do for yourself a lot of the time, and giving you the skills that you need to grow the things that have been instilled inside of you from the day you were born. And so for you, it's an entrepreneurial world. You know, you said entrepreneur, but you are an entrepreneur. You're an author. You know, you're an athlete. You are an athlete. To me, you are an athlete. I want to just say that to you. You're an entrepreneur. You're a provider for your family. You're a farmer. You grow everything around you, including the humans. Doesn't have to be fruits and vegetables. You're still a farmer in that sense. You know, so I've thought about this a lot as we've been doing these episodes, and I just really wanted to leave you with those things. Like, you're only at the beginning. And thank you again, Monica, for coming on the show. Thank you, everyone in the audience, for starting to listen to this show. We're starting to pick up numbers already. It's pretty awesome. I'm a little bit surprised. I really expected a much slower start, but I'm humbled by this. It obviously means that the message ones like Monica that we've already started releasing are awesome. This is the third one we've recorded with her. Right now, there's only one released, and we're starting to release them. And a second one just released yesterday, actually. I'm looking now, and they're gaining momentum. And her story's being heard, and that's the point why we go through it also, guys, is so we can lead others that are in hardship, other humans that are living in free will that don't know they have a choice. So.
Oh, yeah. I receive everything. Thank you so much, Justin. It is amazing. You guys will have to check out my book because there's so much more detail in there. I just feel like it's this never-ending story. And, you know, it's funny, as my husband has told me. He's like, he told me he thought I wrote that book too soon. I said, I don't think I wrote it too soon. I was called to write that book. I fought it because I didn't want my family upset with me. I didn't want a lot of to expose myself that vulnerably. And God just kept honestly like forcing me. I mean, he's like, no, you need to do this. And, you know, when I would buck or be like, I'm not sure if my mom is going to be happy with me. I don't want her upset with me. I love my mom. He's like, I got this. Don't worry about it. And, you know, it's not even been an issue on those ends. All the issues that I had for my book releasing had technical, lots of just hitting the wall and that stuff, but not it emotionally lined up, streamlined down the everything that I was fearful of turned out more than good.
Yeah, and I think that we write books, and books have this tendency to come back later on or be used later. I mean, we still use Napoleon Hill's mm-hmm. books, you know, we still use the Bible. It wasn't written by Jesus, but we still use it, you know, and there's a lot of books like that that still are around. You know, Shakespeare, you know, they were plays. Think about that. Now they're books.
It's coming into fruition. So,
yeah.
And it just released in November. So it's one of those things. And the local support that I had around that book was huge. It put me in the top 100 the first 48 hours that it was released, but I didn't make it to number one. But I'm so grateful for the amount of local support that I've had. So just because they've seen the story, so it's different when someone has experienced and watched it unfold too. And I feel like in the local community, a lot of people feel like they're definitely a part of that story, which they are. So
I agree.
It's awesome. Well, thank you for having me.
Yep. And thank you, everyone, for listening in. Like it. Keep sharing these episodes. Write comments. I hope Monica shares her entire story now that the trilogy's out. But there is going to be a part four, guys. There's the future and where Monica's going that we haven't even talked about. And thank you again, everyone, for listening in. You can find me on Instagram at Justin Bizarro, BIZZARRO. You can also find me on Facebook under the same name. And lastly, you can find us on Spotify or wherever else you grow yourself through podcasts, and we're out.